We're talking to Bernie Moreau. He is an excellent comic book artiste who's been in the comic scene for, I don't want to say eons because that's almost exaggerating, but
30 years.
30 years. That's, wow, that's amazing. That's amazing.
Time goes by no matter what you do. It just goes by. And the older I get, the faster it goes by. So I wouldn't be, hopefully I'll be able to say, I've been doing this for 50 years, you know.
Well, you're most famous probably for your Grendel work, but my favorite work of yours is The Jam. And so I wanted to start at the beginning of your career and kind of go through it a bit, and then we'll get to the good stuff. You know, you just told me, and this is so incredible, that you actually worked on the heavy metal movie.
That's right. That was one of the first really good paying jobs I ever got. Prior to that, it was minimum wage, washing dishes or what have you. But then while I was going to CEGEP here in Quebec, in Montreal, I heard about the heavy metal film, which was setting up production in the city and had this huge cattle call for artists to work as animators and painters and designers on the film. And I showed up, and such was their need that even though I didn't really know animation at the time, I got hired for the work. And everybody that I worked with were so nice and so helpful that they brought me up to speed and helped me to fulfill the role of an assistant animator. And it was a lot of fun. Lasted for about a year.
What did you do? Did you do the backgrounds or the people, the hair, the coloring, everything?
As an assistant animator, my job was to fill in the designs of the key animation. That's somebody, they do all the basic key drawings, the heights, the high points of the motion, and an in-betweener following a guide that the animator would provide would fill in the in-between images and make it all as smooth as possible. And also when that was over, I went to the paint and trace department, which was all about painting on cell, and I fell in love with that, which led to a whole bunch of comic art coloring that I did using animation cell painting style, and that was a lot of fun. So I have heavy metal to thank for all of that.
Which pieces did you work on? Did you say you worked on the whole movie or just one specific segment?
Yeah, only one segment was made in Montreal. That was the Tarnas segment. That was where they took Mobius's character. Mobius, a very famous French cartoonist, he had a character that had appeared in Pilote magazine called Arzak, who was sort of a futuristic, spiritual pterodactyl riding dude who was very holy and had cosmic experiences with crystals. And heavy metal, of course, they North Americanized it in that they changed Arzak into a chainmail bikini wearing babe with an eye patch.
Of course, it's heavy metal after all, not metal hurlant.
That's right, and that segment was called the Tarna sequence. Heavy metal was about five or six different bits. Each bit was done, some in London, England, some in the United States, all over the world parts of that movie were made.
Now, did you get to meet any cool people like Mobius, or have the people that you worked with formerly gone on to greater things?
Well, I worked briefly with Brent Boats, who is a Vancouverite, and it was funny to meet him and to listen about his career after that. He designed the Ghostbusters logo that got the film production crew sued by Harvey Comics, claiming that Mr. Boats had copied their ghost Fatso from the Casper comic a little too closely. That was fun. But other than that, to all the people there, whether they're famous or not, they were all wonderful artists from all over the world, and they're really helpful. That's the main thing. They're really generous, and no one kept anything back as a trade secret. Everybody was just like being surrounded by 50 teachers.
That's a fantastic beginning.
Yeah.
Now, speaking of teachers, were you drawing as a child and you've just been drawing ever since, or was it something you got into in high school?
I was pretty late. I think it was 18 before I seriously decided I was going to draw comics specifically. I started out being into collecting butterflies, and I did that obsessively. Then I switched over to building airplane models, and I did that obsessively. And then, only when I was 17 or 18, I had stopped all that stuff and spent a few years kind of listening to music and meeting girls and all that stuff. And then all of a sudden, I started going to CEGEP in Montreal, and there was this one-hour bus ride between the rural town that I was living in, Rodden, Quebec, and Montreal. And I started reading comic books just to pass the time along the bus ride. They were all Marvel and DC superhero comics, and I thought they were all terrible. But they really inspired me to try and make my own and to do better.
Have you had any formal training?
No, school was always very kind of, I always lived in rural communities. I always got taught math by a science teacher, and a nun would teach me geography, you know. Never had a very precise education, and especially art. Art was always like an extra, a nicety that wasn't necessarily on the curriculum. It was only after I started going to SACEP that I took a few art courses that it really sort of sharpened my desire to do it. I felt like I had a facility for it, and it really gave me a lot of enjoyment.
Now, you mentioned that the Jam was appearing first in Northgard. Would you say that's the first comic you had published, or was it Mackenzie Queen?
Well, when I was about 18 or so and living in Montreal for the first time, I met Mark Shainbloom and Gabrielle Morissette. The two of these guys together made Matrix Graphics Series, which was the name of their company. And that was an entity designed to launch their comic Northgard, which was like a Captain America but a la Canada. And I met with them and we got along well. They invited me to contribute a backup story, and that was my sort of superhero satire character called the Jam, who basically wears the superhero type outfit but has no superpowers whatsoever.
Yeah, he likes to take the dog for walks.
If he can pay the rent, that's a good day. That's a superpower.
Yeah. I love him. He's very funny. So from the Jam, you started meeting other people in the comics community, specifically in Montreal, or from all the outer world as well?
I used to go to MapleCon, my one and only real comic convention, which was in Ottawa. And that was a place I got to kind of, not necessarily meet, but to hang out on the edge of the crowd and watch celebrities who were famous cartoonists and that I knew of, because I was right into the stuff they were doing, the Iron Man, the Hulk. I love superhero comics. I mean, when I was younger, I always read Peanuts and Nancy and all these old-style comics, and I always enjoyed them, but they never really inspired me to make comics, not like the superhero stuff. For some reason, I guess maybe it's being a young boy, you know, and the whole wham, pow thing.
Well, and then having all these crazy powers.
Yeah, and more than that, it seemed to be like literature that was devoted strictly to justice and the consideration of justice and what was right and wrong. And that really catches your sort of sense of honor. And when it's well done, it can be very kind of morally uplifting. Mm-hmm. You know, so I really enjoyed that aspect, though. Of course, that's gone to heck over the last couple of years.
They've come a bit darker.
Yeah, for, you know, I guess money talks, and if these dark stories didn't make a lot of money, then they wouldn't get made and everything would be all morally upright, you know.
So tell me about Mackenzie Queen.
Mackenzie Queen was the result of my intense desire to do a Steve Ditko, Stan Lee, Doctor Strange story. I just read a couple of collections of their early work on that character from Marvel, and it just had so much atmosphere, and the artwork was so original and personal that it really moved me a lot and inspired me to throw myself headlong into my first series. Mackenzie Queen ended up being 5 issues long, and it got collected once by Caliber Comics. That was about 15 years ago. And it's still hanging around. I still like to contribute more to that character and get an ultimate collection sometime. Perhaps touch up the artwork again. That's always a temptation. Definitely I'd like to smooth some edges. But I still like the work, you know. All the old stories that I've done, they're all like my children. And I love them all. And I'm not ashamed of any of them. And I'll bring them out anytime, anywhere.
After Mackenzie Queen, is that when you started to get noticed by Matt Wagner?
I sent Matt Wagner a fan letter. He had just been doing Mage at the time, which was getting a lot of critical attention. And I wrote him a letter that was sort of like, well, yes, your work is interesting, but you really don't put a lot of backgrounds in. It could be really improved if you did more background work. You know, don't be scared of the work. The big sound effects are great, but let's have some background information. And he wrote me back, which was a surprise. Or he didn't write me back, he called me. And, hello, Bernie Miro there, this is him, this is Matt Wagner. And I thought, oh my God, I've upset him.
So much, he's
criticism.
Calling me.
You know, he's calling me to chew my ass or something. You know, I had a negative reaction. But he was very kind and invited me to do a small run on Grendel, a 3-issue run. Grendel was very kind of a hot comic book at the time. The first 10 issues have been done by the Panda Brothers, who are very powerful artists.
Yeah, I gotta say that's one of the craziest things about Grendel is the fact that he picks some really, not, I don't want to say wacky artists, but not exactly your stereotypical superhero cartoonists. You know what I mean? Like, the Panda Brothers style, whenever I introduce that book to anybody, they're always really taken aback by it, because it is kind of wacky. I love it, though. I'm a big Panda Brothers fan.
Sure. Well, the first time I saw their work, I thought, this stuff looks like Nagel, the illustrator from Playboy, who does very slick kind of female busts kind of things. I remember Duran Duran.
It's really 80s.
Yeah. And I thought, it kind of looks like that. But then they really grew. They grew a lot. And if you look at work they've done, like Triple X, which was a collection from Dark Horse, very political, very beautifully done. They've really grown a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so Matt Wagner was always very bold in his choice of artists, and I was lucky enough to be somebody that his whim favored that day, you know.
Now, how did you feel going from your own creator title that you pretty much did everything on to just illustrating somebody else's work?
It could have been disastrous, but Matt Wagner made it a really free environment where he really encouraged me to contribute and be a part of the process. It was really kind of like an idyllic situation that spoiled me for the hell that's out there. I mean, I've worked with other editors who insist on nonsensical changes that you can't argue. Ultimately, you're just like a rough tradesman that they really can't believe is talking back to them, you know? Mm-hmm. It's bizarre. So it could have been really rough going from total freedom to a really tightly restricted thing, but Matt made it a lot of fun.
And how much of Grendel have you done in total? Was that the only thing you've done? Is those three issues?
I did three issues.
Because you've also colored quite a few of them, too.
Yeah, I went on to work for almost 10 years on that franchise in various functions there. I colored for quite a bit of it and did some inking and worked as Matt Wagner's assistant on some earlier issues. So I feel like I'm part of the history of that character.
How do you feel about that character?
Well, it's like a farm, you know, the Grendel farm. It did a lot of years on that farm, you know. You know, it was with Comic-Con, with Dark Horse. They're both pretty stripped down kind of business entities. Never a lot of money there. And so after a while, I just started saying, well, if I'm going to work for almost nothing, let it be on my own work. Mm-hmm. Let's make a mark instead of just being somebody's helper. And so, you know, trying to be independent. But then, of course, work drops off into nothing. And so since then, I've taken part-time jobs and supported myself doing various other things, but still always with an eye towards making good comics.
So one of the interesting things that happened while you were doing Grendel is you got a fan letter from Mike Allred.
Yeah, Michael Allred wrote me. He had just gotten out of the U.S. Air Force from Germany, I think. He was a cameraman, a DJ, you know, totally done it all. And he was very, very kind in his support of my work and offered to work together. And that led to quite a few collaborations that I'm very proud of.
Could you tell us about some of them?
Oh, well, his character Madman is basically, when he's not in costume, as I understand it, a fellow named Frank Einstein, who is the survivor of a traffic accident, who is operated on by a mad doctor and presumably given another brain with psychic abilities. And so he's a bit of a superhero and his memories are muddled.
But his hot girlfriend helps him out.
Yeah, and Michael draws a wonderful woman, you know. And over the years, his style has grown from something that looked kind of like really Panda Brothers or Nagel, like almost like advertising art, into this really lush, thick brush style that is almost reminiscent of Yves Chalin from Europe, you know, like very, very bold contour lines, which I find
it's really very tight, though, too, his art style. Like, he's really bang on with the anatomy and, yeah, the style, too.
Yeah, when I first looked at his work, I said, you should stop using photo reference and just be more natural. And he goes, I don't use photo reference.
Nice.
Yeah.
He's a very interesting artist. So another thing that you guys initially did was Everyman?
That's right. He got a deal with Epic Comics right at the time when Carl Potts was kind of heading up their more Marvel's more experimental comic line. Michael was just coming off of Graphic Music and a bunch of other projects that had given him more and more renown. And so he got Marvel to do this project where he wrote it and penciled it, and I inked it, lettered it, and colored it. And it was sort of a witch story about a young woman who lives in a rural community and is killed, murdered by sort of her misogynistic male neighbors who, you know, don't like her because she's a witch. And but really, they just try and, like, you know, rape her, but that doesn't work out, so she ends up dead. And she comes, thanks to certain magic, she comes back, but in the body of this androgynous man who has these sex organs that you never see, but apparently they're a blend of both, you know. I thought, wow, that'd be great, we gotta do that on a splash page. But Marvel is so conservative, you know.
It's a really strange story when you consider everything Mike Allred's done since, because his writing is usually quite tame.
He's always been plugged into deep into his subconscious, I think. I really think he looks deep into his psyche for themes that interest him. And if you look at the work now, he's done quite a bit of religious work. Mm-hmm. He's into the Mormon faith.
Yeah.
And he's done a lot of, obviously, thought about it a lot. It'd be interesting to meet and talk with him again after 20 years.
And the other thing you guys did was the Madman Jam.
That was sort of the reverse of the Everyman project, in that with Everyman, he conceived it, he drew it, I inked it, lettered it, and colored it. Now, with the Madman Jam, I conceived it, I penciled it, he picked out what he wanted to ink and inked it, I contributed with inking as well, and then lettered it as well, and he colored it, his wife colored it. So that was an interesting switch up. And it's a compliment to how much fun he is to work with, that it's possible to actually see these experiments realized. He's really flexible and, you know, not an ego at all.
You've had some excellent collaborations.
I've been lucky, definitely.
When you were finished doing Grendel, you started doing your own solo jam comic. How long did that series go on?
Oh, it went on about, well, it's still ongoing, but after about six publishers, I mean, it went from being published by Matrix Graphics Series, it went to Kimiko, and then from Kimiko to Slave Labor, and then, no, I might have that mixed up, but from Slave Labor went to Dark Horse, Dark Horse, it went to Caliber. All of these companies were enthusiastic to take it up, but then after a couple of issues said, well, this isn't making any money,
yeah. So
we'll have to let you go. So I had like six different publishers, and the graphic novel that I'm working on now, To Get Her, which I've been working on for about 4 years and features Gordy and Janet from my series The Jam, that's, I'm looking at probably self-publishing that myself. But in this day and age, I think that's more possible than ever before, and I think cartoonists can really get their work out there by taking that sort of destiny into their own hands and investing a couple of $100 in themselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, printing costs are so cheap. I know a lot of people are going to Singapore these days to get stuff printed because it's insanely cheap out there.
Sure, they even have Xerox machines that can make square-bound books for you in lots of, like, 10, you know?
And so while you were doing the Solo Jam comic, you were also doing various coloring jobs?
Yeah, all the work I've gotten from the mainstream has not been drawing. I penciled two stories for DC. One was a Clayface 2 story written by Dan Raspler, and in one of the Secret Origin books, the Secret Origin of Clayface 2. I forget what number that was.
I know the other thing.
The Riddler story. Yeah,
but it was written by Neil Gaiman, was it not? Because when I just started to do research on you, that is cited so often when your name comes up. I was just like, that's actually pretty illustrious to be with Gaiman.
Well, that was at a time when Matt Wagner was living in Montreal because he was courting his wife-to-be, who was Diana Schutz's sister, who was a native of Montreal. And we briefly shared a studio, so a lot of our work was kind of mixed up. That story, I got apparently through Mark Wade, thanks to Ty Templeton, who said, I'm too busy to do it, Mark. How about you give Bernie Miro a try? Mm-hmm. And Mark Wade was experimental enough to go, okay, Bernie Miro, I don't know who you are, but Ty recommends you. That's good enough for me. Let's go. And so Neil Gaiman, of course, oh my God, I get to illustrate the Neil Gaiman story. That's an honor, and I was up for the challenge. Matt Wagner inked it. Joe Matt colored it.
Wow.
And I got to letter it myself. And to my knowledge, I think that may be one of the first non-standard DC comic books where the lettering is actually more personal.
Oh.
Because generally all their lettering is totally all the same. Like mm-hmm. Very pro, very regular looking. Mine was much more organic, but I thought it would get stopped in editorial, but it wasn't.
And so that's really exciting. As someone who would read superhero comics for a while, get to do a superhero comic. Is the Riddler someone you were ever interested in, or
well,
did you be like, oh man, I can really go to town?
Sure. I was always a big fan of the Batman TV show growing up, and Frank Gorshin, the actor who played the Riddler in that series, always scared the shit out of me. So that was like a very special association that gave me some energy, gave me a connection to the character. But other than that, any sort of mainstream superhero, any character, no matter how ridiculous, can be still approached with a sort of sense of irony and humor and stuff, and it'd be interesting to work with any of these icons, you know, but the editors and the people in charge of the whole business, you know, make it so hard to get across the fence. They gatekeep so jealously that only their friends get in it, seemingly. Mm-hmm. And so the regular artists can pretty much get easily discouraged about the idea of trying to work on a Superman or a Batman story. So we might as well just publish our own stuff. And, you know, hopefully soon those things will all be in the public domain, because all these various business entities like Marvel and DC will get so tangled up in other businesses and conglomerates that it'll all come crashing down because some bank goes bankrupt in South Africa. And then all of a sudden all these Jack Kirby gems will be floating in space to be plucked by anybody, you know. I'd love to do a Thor comic.
That's a beautiful dream.
Mm. I've always been waiting for Marvel to totally dissolve into chaos. You know, they have all this beautiful stuff, but they seem to be really thoughtless about it. But lately, with all their Essentials collections and black and white reprinting of old work and everything, who'd have thought they'd smarten up at the last minute? You know, like, now grudgingly I have to give it to them in that they seem to be using their resources better.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, but it just breaks my heart to think about Jack Kirby and all those great artists who handed in their artwork and then had their pages taken and cut in half after the book was printed. As just like the standard printer saying, these are done. How do I mark it? I'll destroy them.
I'm chilled to the bone to hear that. I'm like, that's art.
Yeah. Or you walk into the Marvel offices and there's been a bit of snow in, you know, 1965 Manhattan. So they have artist artwork covering the floor.
No, that's so horrible.
The boots don't dirty the floor.
You're joking.
No, that's something I read in a book. I can't say, you know, it's like third hand or... It's not, it's just hearsay, but...
mind-blowing.
That kind of thoughtlessness, that kind of, you know...
I know, to somebody's work. You know, in daycare, we don't let them wreck each other's work. Like, if they knock over their toys, it's like, look, they worked on that. Now help them rebuild it.
Well, that's, you know, if only that had been part of our societal makeup more, then comics might be further ahead than they are today.
While you were doing all this extra stuff for Dark Horse, you also did some Blair Witch and anything else?
I worked for Oni for a bit doing... when the Blair Witch film came out, they got the license for it, and it was pretty exciting. It was a big indie hit at the time. So I remember being inspired to work on some material there that turned into almost 40 pages of material in the end that I did for the first a one-issue special and then a three-issue miniseries.
Did you have to watch the movie?
They set up a screening for me, but I'm ashamed to say I didn't go because I'm not a big fan of horror films and I'm very susceptible to that kind of thing, and mm-hmm. I don't want to, you know, waste time having nightmares because I can imagine horror, no problem, you know. I can do it just enough that I can feel it, and mm-hmm. a lot of it was in the dark, a lot of blackness, you know. I didn't capitalize on that as much. It was kind of tempting.
Yeah.
No, well, I could do every page just different panels.
Well, it's
all
a
black.
Shaky camera anyways. Let's just do some lines and blurriness.
Right. But in the end, I kind of got into the mythos of the whole thing. I like early Americana.
Mm-hmm.
I find
it's like Sleepy Hollow.
Yeah, I find it a very interesting aesthetic. Mike Mignola seems to set a lot of his Hellboy stuff
that
flavor.
Yeah.
And I enjoy that.
And then you went on to do Dr. Robot?
Dr. Robot, yes. That's a manifestation of my love for art and toys from Japan. And definitely, I discovered anime with a little bit of help from my friends pretty late in the thing. I mean, when I was first getting into anime, Ninja Scroll was already out,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Yeah. But that's a classic, too, though.
Kawajiri is a filmmaker that I really respect. He's very dark and very scary, but, Vampire Hunter D, Bloodlust,
yeah.
You know.
Battle Angel Alita was my first one. That was high school.
See, I don't think I've seen that.
Oh, it's great. Apparently James Cameron's making a live-action version of it right now.
Oh, really?
That's what it's a rumor. That's what I heard.
Well, I'm still waiting for this wave of Hollywood mega 3D action that we've been hearing about.
Oh, it's coming.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward. There's a cartoon. It's Monsters vs. Aliens. I think it's a new Pixar or something that looks really good.
Yeah.
And
you
got to
wear, like, gray polarized glasses. Mm-hmm.
It's the new thing. It's funny because I babysit this kid and he's totally talking crazy about 3D. And I've got actually some old 1980s, like, Eclipse 3D comics. And he's like, you do? Can you bring them? And I'm just like, this is so weird. I'm sure when the first trend came around, they were all really obsessive about it. But it's going to die, like, in a year, you know?
I remember going to Walt Disney World and Captain EO, this 3D movie made by John Landis, featuring Michael Jackson, was playing.
That's bizarre.
It really was bizarre, but the 3D effects, they gave you these, it wasn't one lens red, one lens
green, blue
or green. Mm-hmm. It was just these sort of gray glasses that you wonder what they did, but apparently they get opaque kind of at predetermined moments, like it's like timed or something. Anyway, the 3D effects were great, you know, this planetoid is like rotating right in front of your face. You almost have to stop yourself from reaching out because really looks like it's...
Well, IMAX does them and I love those. I've seen like the under ocean ones because you're like touching the fish and they're right in front of you.
It's amazing the way that effect can work. So I look forward to well done stuff. And when you're doing 3D stuff, then you really have to design stuff with that in mind. So that a good designer in that sense could really make something really exciting.
What is Dr. Robot about exactly? He's a doctor.
He's like Super Mario, except he's not a plumber, he's a doctor, and he's about 4 feet tall, and he's sort of this Caucasian looking guy with a big mustache, kind of a little bit Italian-y somehow. He's bald and he wears clinical white, and he's not only a master of the human anatomy, he can also design autonomous robots and artificial life.
Now, didn't one of the stories appear in an Oni collection?
No, they were a backup in Michael Allred's Mad Men.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I did one story and I sent it to Michael Allred and he said, this is great, do three more and I'll feature it as a backup in the next four of my issues. And so that kind of encouraged me to do that. And then Diana Schutz said, well, we can do a Dr. Robot project, you know, just collect all these stories and make a book, add some extra material. I was like, that's great. That means I'll actually get paid for the money, for the work. And she's like, well, no, if we have to pay for anything, then we can't do this project.
That's harsh.
So, you know, I wonder, am I like the only guy who's ever, like, you know, had a book put out by Dark Horse, you know, that did it for nothing and didn't even get a page rate? That's like me and Dark Horse, you know, it's just...
That's so... I'm amazed.
But
when did you hook up with...
It was a beautiful book, and I'm glad I did it.
I like it. I like it a lot.
Thank
you. The color is nice.
Young
girls
seem to like it, too.
Well, it's really clean. And I always gravitate to the clean stuff before I go for the ugly, messy stuff. So I can see how young girls are like that, too. They're all about the color. They need color, and it needs to be clean. I know, because I teach young girls with comics. So.
Well, I like to think that, you know, it's meant for children. Like, all the stuff I do now, hopefully it works on different levels. a kid can enjoy it. There's nothing... I never do gore or anything. always trying.
You're no Richard Corbin?
No. I wish.
So when did you hook up with Jim Ottaviani?
He's somebody who got in touch with me, like Mike Allred, through the mail.
I have a couple of the books. I really love Dignifying Science, because what he does is he focuses on science, and he does, like, science comics, and it's a really great way to be educated through comics. I love Dignifying Science.
Yeah, he's got, like, an educational slant on these things, and actually, you know, sells to in that market. So that's definitely a niche that not many people are doing, and he's a very smart guy, very nice man. So it was great working on the stuff like surrounding the science of the atomic bomb and all that stuff. Really interesting from working on these historical and biographical comics, which I've done more and more of late. Researching is proving to be really interesting, and I'm finding an interest in history that I never knew I possessed. In my memory of going through the subject in high school was just like I would draw something else and not even listen. But nowadays, I'm really finding it fascinating.